You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast, where we discuss everything about Star Trek, The Next Generation. And tonight's episode is The Ensigns of Command. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
And the synopsis for tonight's show is, Data must convince a colony of approximately a dozen or so people, according to Commander Riker, but turns out to be 15,000 people to evacuate before the aliens who own the planet arrive. New aliens we'd never heard about, but boy, are they scary. This is the second episode of Season 3 of TNG. Its original release date was October 2nd, 1989, written by Melinda Snodgrass and directed by Cliff Bull. Guest stars for tonight's show. There's only a few listed, but there are more. Starts out with Eileen Seeley as Audrian McKenzie, Mark Taylor as Heratath, or he goes by Harry, Richard Allen as Kentor, and let me find him. Granger Hines as Goshavin. He came in as an uncredited co-star, but I think Goshavin's got a pretty big role in this, so we should put him in there. And Mark McChesney, Mark McChesney as the Shellyak corporate, I guess you could say, public affairs person. and finally, Cole Meany as Miles O'Brien. So what do we think about this one? I like it. I like putting Data on the spot, and Data's not perfect. If Data had been perfect, he would have already had solved the problem early on instead of waiting 40-some minutes to devise a plan. But beyond that, I'm not so sure I would have done any different. I probably would have just beamed back up to the ship and said, screw these guys. If whoever wants to come with me, come with me. Whoever wants to stay, stay. But I guess that would shorten the episode. The Shellyak. I wish we could have kept them around a little longer. They are mysterious. I can't even tell if that's a person or an object that plays the Shellyak. There's no face. Discernible face. All we see are his wings coming up and down. So I'm not sure if he's maybe facing the opposite direction and has, you know, isn't going to give the humans the luxury of seeing his real face. I don't know. But anyway, what about you, Doc?
Well, I mean, regarding the Shellyak, I always just thought it was like a coat playing the role of the of the guy that's the interface between the ship and Picard. No, I actually also like this episode. I think this episode is good. I'm a big Data fan and was a big Data fan certainly when I was watching this the first time when I was growing up. I like what Data goes through and how he has to solve the problem. And actually, you know, looking at this more critically, you see there's also the reflection of the same story on the planet with Picard and, you know, him talking to the to the Shellyak and the way he has to solve his problem. So I actually quite like this. I think this is a nice, you know, a nice Data story, and it's good to kick off season 3 with some good stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another thing is I like the fact that Data is alone. You know, Geordi's not there to help advise him. I mean, Riker was on the comm, telling him what it's going to be like if he doesn't succeed in his mission. But other than that, he's on his own. Even Wesley's not there to come up with the trick of the day. So, Okay, at this...
Is Wesley in this episode?
Just
the back of my mind, I can't quite remember him in any of the scenes. He might have been in the background. But you are right, the episode puts together a relatively, you know, potentially an artificial construct that does leave Data alone on the on the planet. And he has to do his thing. I also there's one thing that's slightly in the background in this episode is that I like that Geordi and O'Brien get given the impossible mission to fix the transporters, and they don't do it, or they can't do it, and it, in the end it doesn't matter. And I quite like that kind of throwaway line that you know that the entire engineering crew is extremely busy throughout the episode, but you don't see them. And then when they do come up with whatever they need to come up with, it's like, don't worry, we've fixed it now. I think that's a little bit more realistic than them being, you know, critical to the mission every single week.
Yeah, right. And now that you mentioned that, yes, Wesley was attempting to help fix the transporter problem as well. I mean, that was just a classic. So how are you progressing? Oh, about like you'd expect. That was awesome there. Okay, normally at this point we would do a forum feedback, but we'll end the show and say, now stick around for the forum feedback, and we'll do it. Whoever wants to continue on, continue on. The people who would normally try and flash forward to the point where the forum is gone and we can finally get into the show that we are talking about, you don't have to do that any longer. So hopefully we'll see when we get forum feedback how you feel about that, and we'll do whatever people want.
Yes, Lua, not to let any kind of daylight upon magic here, but also the same thing that happened last week as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I just want to reiterate that. Thank you, James. Crap. What am I doing? You're right. All right. I might get rid of that whole thing.
Don't get rid of it.
No, we'll put it in as a blooper.
Don't get rid of it. It will be like the writers, I don't know, making O'Brien play the cello and then it never come up ever again.
Ever again. That's a first thing on my notes for today.
Absolutely.
I haven't seen this one in a long time. Honestly, when we see the players, the band players, I've never really looked at them. I mean, the Vulcan stands out like crazy, but I never really looked at O'Brien sitting there. So, yeah, that'd have been great to have some cello playing on DS9. But, nope, didn't work out. Yeah, I guess maybe he sucked at it. But we don't get to see much of the performance as, you know, Picard is yanked away. Okay, Doctor. The musical piece that they were playing at the beginning and the end, I believe it's the same piece, just in different parts of the performance. Do you know what that is?
I do not know what that is.
Neither do I, because I thought what I want to do is I want to end this show with the way that the episode ends, with that piece taking him out. So instead of doing the usual Picard flute and ending, I want to do that. So we're going to have to look for that. Okay, so the ship is receiving a message from the Shelia Corporate. Corporate? Are they incorporated? Or I have never heard of a species calling themselves the Corporate.
It's kind of the thing that keeps going on, right? That whenever you have the Klingon Empire or the Ferengi Alliance, and they keep having to come up with new names of conglomerates of either a single species or more than one. Down to like the Dominion, quote unquote. It's still a way of describing something under your control. I think that they're scraping a barrel with Corporate, in my mind. I don't know why they particularly used Corporate. I don't think there's anything that resonates with how 20th century humans would use the word Corporate, unless I'm missing something in the episode. If anything, I think it just takes you slightly out of the out of the mysterious nature of the alien, that you might think they might have some stock in these ships.
And you just accept it. Or maybe it's the parent company of several businesses. The Shelyak are one of the companies that the parent Shelyak Corporate owns. But anyway, we haven't heard from them in 111 years, which is interesting since, you know, Captain Kirk never mentioned them. The only thing is, they're pissed. They're pissed. There are humans on the fifth planet of Tau Sigma, and we have better get rid of them in 4 days.
Remove the humans.
Easy enough. So what do you think of the Sheliak? We talked a little bit about them, but it kind of reminded me, looking at the director, when he was on screen and when he was in person, there are little round things, I guess you could say, that are above and below him that made it look like Superman's lair.
I'm lost here.
Do you remember the Sheliak, the leader, the director?
Oh, you mean, yeah, the dude that is, the dude that's what I called at the beginning, the coat.
Yes,
the coat. Standing in for the dude. Yeah. And he's got these kind of crystally things, or at least some type of chandelier that he's standing in.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of Superman's home, you know, when he has this little workstation that's got the crystals.
Oh, I can see that. And when would Superman have been? A couple of years before this? Something like that? Mm-hmm. I think mid-80s. But yeah, maybe they're actually doing a direct reference. I don't know.
Hmm. Okay. So if he pushes this one down, the Enterprise gets destroyed. I'd be curious to find out if they had actually had any weaponry. They said it was, how many times the Enterprise's mass. It was quite a large ship.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm always interested whenever you come across these kind of species that were introduced for the single day, and they say, there's been a hard fought peace, or there's been a unstable peace for the last 2 million years, or whatever they pluck out. I always want to know exactly, what is the background there, because we do come across these guys, right? So the Sheliak is one. I know that we come across, to begin with in TNG, you come across the Ferengi, where it's a bit. People are on heightened alert, but they don't really know them. The Cardassians, you know that there was a war there, and you then have some type of peace towards the end of, at this stage at least, in TNG. I think the, who are the guys in, I think the Breen also suffer from that as well when they're introduced. You get this mysterious angle that you don't get a feeling of how these people had first contact with the Federation. And I would have liked to heard a little bit more of the background.
Yeah, right. And there is none. So I'm curious, as I'm looking at Memory Alpha. Yes, I do that, guys. So when we look up the Sheliak, I'm looking for their particular page. And I think the only time that the non-humanoid classification R3 life form is home is located in the Sheliak star system. No kidding. But that's pretty much it. There's talk about the Treaty of Armenes. A governing body called the Corporate. There's basically anything about the Sheliak on Memory Alpha is derived from this episode. Okay, so let's see here. Riker says a planet has heavy concentrations of hyperonic radiations, which humans can't survive in. So sometimes certain radiation forms that they use are derived from real stuff. Is hyperonic real?
No, not as far as I know. I'm pretty certain that it's not real.
Okay. So we got to save the 15,000, over 15,000 colonists who have figured out a way to counteract the hyperonic radiation. They were descendants of the colony ship Artemis, who was actually on its way. Now, this is interesting. Who was actually on its way to Septimus Minor. Does that sound odd to you in any way?
What, that they were going to a different place and got kind of sent off course?
The planet that they were heading for, Septimus Minor, does that strike you as funny in any way?
No, not really.
Okay. Septimus would be another word for septum. What's a septum?
Go and enlighten me.
Part of the nose. Your septum is in your nose. And miners are like gold pickers. You know, miners, they pick for...
Sure.
So, septimus minor is another word for nose pickers.
Is this... Okay.
That's just my opinion.
Deliberate?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, think about it. Septimus minor. No, it's another word for nose picker. I think so. I think it's pretty damn funny that they use Septimus minor, and I can't imagine some writer somewhere picking that word going, oh, this is going to be funny. No one's going to get it. I don't know. It just feels like Septimus minor nose picker.
Okay, I'll take you on that. It has never occurred to me.
Well, these are the kind of things I think about when I'm all alone and the power goes out. Plus, we both have children. We've seen that done many, many times. Okay, so we've arrived, and Worf confirms the presence of life forms. Wouldn't it be funny if Worf broke out into a song about life forms? Oh, wait, never mind. I'm doing a lot to make the doctor laugh. It ain't working, guys. Ugh, new baby's getting him tired.
No, I think that is true. That is true.
Okay. So, we got to get him off the planet. How are we going to do this? The transporters won't work. Phasers are down as well. They bring up the fact that the phasers are down. And the Sheliak will exterminate the human infestation. So we have to send Data down there to prepare them for transport, which you would think is easy enough. No, not so.
Now, I do have to say, I do like the setup of this episode. I think it's... there are a number of these episodes, and also, I mean, frankly, also Insurrection, the film, right, mm-hmm. that deal with ideas of, like, forced relocation. And I think that each one of them, whether it's this one or I think Homeward does it as well, and then Insurrection and then Journey's End and all of the issues regarding the Maquis and all of it, there are kind of different aspects of, of the issues that get raised, that get dealt with. I quite like that this is... I think the way they try to keep it relatively black and white, which is that, these guys are, they are kind of in the wrong for being down there. And then I think there aren't many debating points about whether or not they should leave or whether they should stay there. So they, in the end, they do get off, they get taken away. It's all, the story always it fully revolves around Data's ability to communicate this to the people on the planet. And I quite like it. I like that at this stage you are pretty much told that, look, these guys are in danger being there. They really shouldn't have been there in the first place. We have to make sure that they're aware of that, and that there's this great force coming, and don't underestimate that these guys can get wiped out like vermin if they if they hang around. And I like the I like that setup.
Yeah. Okay. 15,253, that's how many are on the planet. Worf calculates at the tap of four keys, no less, that the evacuation...
I needed six.
Yeah, I did too, yeah. Well, yeah, the evacuation... Well, see, the thing is, I don't know how much the capacity of each shuttle is, but it takes 4 weeks and 4 days. Now, I assume that's 24 hours around the clock, or 26 hours in Bajoran time. So I guess the calculation might be different for Bajorans. We have to ask the Sheliak for more time.
I think that this sounded a little long, right? I would have imagined. Okay, it obviously depends. There are lots of unknown quantities involved, right? You don't know how many shuttles you have. You don't know how many people can fit on each shuttle. And you don't know how long it's going to take you to go down to the planet, pick people up, and then bring them up again. To me, this sounds like a fairly long time that Worf quotes. You don't have all the information to be able to do the calculation. You don't know how many shuttles the Enterprise has, how many people can fit into a shuttle, and also how long it's going to take each shuttle to do one trip. But when I just did a rough estimate myself, I reckon it would only take them around 4 days. So I think Worf is being extra lazy this week.
Maybe there's only 8-hour shifts.
Yeah, well, I think that was based on, I think, you know, something like five shuttles with, you should be able to get five shuttles, 10 people in each, running full time. And I don't know what I gave them. It might have been 15 minutes up and down. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if we've ever discussed this before, nor can I think of any episode where this would have been true, but the Enterprise cannot land, can it?
No, I don't think... No, the Enterprise can't land.
Okay.
Starships can't land. That would be silly. And also, while we're at it, starships are constructed in space because, you know, you wouldn't construct a starship on the planet. That would be silly, too.
Yeah. Well, there's somebody somewhere that's going to remind me that Voyager landed. And the Enterprise, the original Enterprise, was actually created on Earth.
No, it wasn't.
Well, according to JJ, it was. I mean,
yeah, I know. I'm making that very subtle jibe at the at 09.
Yeah. So we're not sure what the Enterprise can or cannot do. The writers never took us there. So because obviously, if the ship can land, just everybody walk up the ramp and they'd be done in 5 hours.
Although, when you're getting towards 15,000, right, it's, I'm not entirely sure whether or not you can handle 15,000 people on the Enterprise.
Mm.
It seems like a pretty large number of people, just in terms of getting sleeping quarters. I know that in the past we've done the joke that, you know, just shove them all into the holodeck, because that seems to have an infinite supply of space.
Yeah, right.
Walls
are still there.
I don't think you can... It's going to be a struggle, you know, even if you did have the time to get them all on the Enterprise.
Well, they were going to. I mean, when they were running, when he said 4 weeks, 4 days of constant shuttle use, they had to take them somewhere. So that I assume they were coming to the Enterprise in either way.
No, I agree with that. That was the intention.
Yeah, especially since Starfleet is profuse in its apologies, but they can't arrive for 3 weeks. And that goes back to one of my pet peeves about the Enterprise being the only ship in the area, because, I mean, we've got to have hundreds or thousands of starships all around. I can't imagine only one is in each sector that to help is 3 weeks away. Even if they had to send a boatload of little tiny starships to help them, at least that would have been better than nothing.
It's a valid point. It's, you know, it's always one of the conceits you have to take with Trek, that either Starfleet is really, really, really small and underpowered, or space is really, really, really big.
Yeah, well, or it could be both. So anyway, okay. So Data lands, makes contact with two descendants from the Artemis. And we know they were on their way to Septimus Minor. But the leader, Goshevin, what an idiot. I mean, he wants to fight. But like I said earlier, Data could have said, there's not going to be anything to fight. They'll be sent. Then again, here's another question. Worf made a point to say the phasers were useless. So what do the Sheliak have that the Enterprise doesn't to obliterate the planet?
I mean, you can fire a photon torpedo, right? Or even any kind of kinetic weapon. You know, basically just throw a bowling ball out of the side of the Enterprise from orbit. It's going to hurt when it lands.
Bowling ball.
So I actually suspect it's going to be, you know, it's much, much, much more likely, right, that they'll just either bombard it with some type of weapon, or even just send down some, you know, nasty gas that kills everyone.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, Goshevin has no intention of leaving this planet. They won't be bullied off, not by the Sheliak and not by Data. Obviously, Goshevin is just completely put off by the fact that Data is an android. If Riker went down there, or was able to go down there, do you think the attitude would have been a little bit different?
I know that it is mentioned in the episode about whether or not it's, you know, it's the messenger rather than the message. But I didn't get the impression that that was the case. So you know, despite the fact people did mention, you know, hey, you're not going to be taken seriously as an android, I could very easily conceive that the guy's reaction would have been the same no matter what. So I didn't necessarily see there any kind of overtones of, you know, prejudice from an android's perspective. I think any outsider would have probably had the same reaction. Or he would have had the same reaction to any outsider.
Okay. So,
by the way, I love the way that Data tries to explain everything, and then he says, no, we're going ahead with this. And he goes, well, perhaps I haven't made myself clear. And he does. He has some pretty good Dataisms in this episode.
Yes.
That I enjoy.
Yes, he does. I really, Data carried the day, and it was really, really nice to have Data in command.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Data's turned away and almost hit by a coil spanner or whatever that thing is by Adrienne McKenzie. What do you think of her performance? I liked her. She has a sexuality of Bailey Quarters on WKRP. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but
I have not.
Okay,
I don't know the reference there.
That's okay.
I like the I like the lady. I think she did well. I don't know whether or not they needed to go so far down the route that she was becoming attracted to Data. But in the end, having rewatched it, it was okay. It was perfectly fine. I liked the introduction, and I remember the introduction. I specifically, it's one of the images I have from the episode about how she throws the thing over to Data, and manages to. He manages to catch it using his superhuman reflexes. There was a part of me when I was rewatching that thought, what if that had not happened like that, right? So let's assume that an alien comes down or an android comes down to your world and you want to test his reflexes, so you throw something at him and he doesn't react in time and you whack him around the head. That's not the perfect introduction, especially if you're, if you're kind of on the friendly side of the colonists.
Hmm. Ein klein nat musak. That's it. Okay. I was just reading on... I'm sorry to totally take us off a tangent, but I was reading on Memory Alpha, first movement allegro of Mozart's Ein klein nat musak. And that's when Picard gets called to the bridge. So be curious if it's the same movement, maybe the second movement or something. So now I at least have something to go off of. Okay, so Bailey Quarters, WKRP. Are you familiar with Lonnie Anderson?
No.
Okay, she was a supermodel blonde from the 70s, supposedly one of the hottest women alive. And she and another woman played on this sitcom, WKRP. It's about a fictitional radio station in Cincinnati, and how it was run by complete incompetence, and it's funny. It's one of the funniest shows of the 70s, disco and all included. It is very, very funny.
Now the crowd is curious but well behaved, and I think I hear something now. The crowd is moving out into the parking area, and oh yes, I can see it now. It's a helicopter, and it's coming this way.
A helicopter?
It's flying something behind it. I can't quite make it out. It's a large banner, and it says, Happy Thanksgiving from WKRP. What a sight, ladies and gentlemen. What a sight. The copter seems to be circling the parking area now. I guess it's looking for a place to land. No, something just came out of the back of the helicopter. It's a dark object. Perhaps a skydiver plumbing to the earth from only 2,000 feet into the air. Seconds and a third. There's no parachutes yet.
Those can't be skydivers. I can't tell just yet what they are, but...
Oh, my God, they're talking! Johnny, can you get this? Oh, they're crashing to the earth right in front of my eyes! One just went through the windshield of a parked car! This is terrible.
What is running around pushing each other? Oh, my goodness! Oh, the humanity! Oh, people are running about. The turkeys are hitting the ground like sacks of wet cement. See, folks, I don't know how much longer the crowd is running for their lives. I think I'm going to step inside. I can't stay out here and watch this any longer. No, I can't go in there.
Children are searching for their mothers, and, oh, not since the Hindenburg tragedy has there been anything like this. How much longer I can hold my position here, Johnny? The crowd.
Les, are you there? Les isn't there. Thanks for that on-the-spot report, Les. Those of you who just tuned in, the Pinedale Shopping Mall has just been bombed with live turkey. Film at 11.
Bailey Quarters plays the second female that wasn't as hot as the first one, but quite frankly, a lot of people found Bailey much more sexy than they found Jennifer, the one played by Lonnie Anderson. So there's something for you to check out. But anyway, so yeah, her falling for Data. Who would ever thought of that? They'll probably never have anyone ever fall for Data again. Yeah. Nothing on that.
Huh? I think that, you know, I think that Data is a very clear character for, you know, for people to fall for in a way, in a very similar way to that. You know, despite in the original series Kirk having all of the action, it's kind of Spock, the guy that a lot of I don't want to overgeneralize here and say a lot of women would want to would want to fall for, but there's kind of the mystery about Data, I like the follow-ups that come up with people, you know, Data's relationships, and I'm a big fan of the things like In Theory, when he actually ends up having a relationship for at least a couple of weeks. I think that they didn't necessarily need it today, but I thought it kind of worked. Fine. I could have taken it or leave it.
Okay. And now LaForge and O'Brien, as you mentioned, are given their assignments that nobody wants to hear that's impossible. They want the transporter to work despite the hyper radiation, which of course says, yeah, but that's him. Yes, sir. Okay.
Yep, that was good. And then you don't really see them for quite a while. I think there are like one or two comic shots that you have. I think in particular when I think it's Riker walks in onto the transporter room and this kind of big metal thing's been reduced to a pool of something, and they keep, you know, they keep doing their work in the background, and you know, it's a quite nice thing to keep them busy on.
Mm-hmm. 372 legal experts were sent to negotiate the treaty with the species that we never heard about until today. And what does Picard have? V and me.
No, I think this was... I mean, are there not... Isn't there anyone on the Enterprise that's perhaps more trained towards this kind of thing? I mean, you have engineers and you have security, and is there no one that's... Is there no one that has a law degree? Do they have to rely on on Riker and Picard? I doubt they're the most qualified people to get on with this, and frankly, you know, Riker doesn't do anything. In fact, Troy has more insight into the diplomacy than Riker does, which is completely appropriate given her role.
Right. You know, I'm surprised that since the ship and Data could communicate with each other, that Picard didn't at least try to talk to Gosheven himself. I mean, leader to leader might have made more of an impact.
Yeah, it's strange, right? It is that pretty much, I mean, the story is all about Data doing his thing down on the planet and kind of Picard doing his thing on the ship, and there are parallels between the paths they both have to take. I think that the writers wanted to tell the story of them both, you know, getting over the challenges that they had, and as a result, I think that's why they introduced the artificial constraint whereby Data was supposed to be on the planet and no one was around to help and so on. But you are right, they still had communication, and I think it's... Yeah, I can see that they didn't mention that they couldn't communicate, and it probably would have made sense for, you know, someone like a Troy or a Picard to go down and communicate. And later on, right, when people happen to be moved in the Maquis episodes, it's very clear that Picard's the main, you know, diplomatic dude, and he's the main guy that the leader should be talking to. I think that this episode is much more that trying to focus on the Data story. So it's kind of artificial the way they segregate his role and responsibilities from the rest of the ship. But I quite like it. It's just that there are a few logical holes.
Right. So after Gosheven tells Data to go pack, he doesn't. He stays, and he and Adrian decide to go to her house to work out a plan. Did you notice some of the electrical items in Adrian's house, including what I thought was a robot?
Do you think that it's reasonable that she would have been that interested in robotics and, you know, would have the knowledge to ask Data whether or not he was a, you know, duotronic circuitry and stuff?
Uh-huh.
It's kind of quite convenient, right, that the first or the third person you see is an expert in that field.
Right. And she didn't know positronic was even possible. Well, I don't think anyone knew of positronic until soon, and they've been gone for quite a long time.
Yeah, I think it's around 90 years or so that the planet has been around for.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if she would have said, I didn't know that was possible. But anyway, yeah, Audrey's robot, and she had like a big computer system or lights, you know, lights blinking on the wall. And then several pieces of something on her desk. So, I mean, it looked like DJ equipment. So I wonder what she tinkers with when she's all alone, which she seems to be all alone a lot.
By the way, from the earlier conversations, I forgot to mention the line, that, and I'm sure you noted it as well, which was when she's very excited and goes up to Data and she says, I've got a million questions, and then Data replies that he doesn't have time for a million questions. That's good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or am I just a complete sucker for Data?
Oh, no, yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I do not have time for a million questions. Look at the thing, because, you know, I'm going to jump ahead. I don't understand why she didn't go with Data. I mean, why did she have to wait for the colony ship to arrive in 4 weeks? Or, I mean, they gave him 4 weeks. So obviously the 3 week that Starfleet was profuse in its apology for is enough to get them off the ship or off the planet. But I'm curious why she didn't just go first. It's like, I'm thinking of an episode where Riker tries to fit in with a group of people, not the Mintakans. That'll be coming up soon. But it's another future episode where they actually find him, beat him up, take him to their hospital, discover he's not one of them.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about the First Contact. Season 4 episode.
Yes.
When he ends up having to escape after promising sexual services to what's her name from Frasier?
I think it's B.B. Newirth or something.
Yes, indeed. That's the actress's name, yes.
Yeah, I would have been okay with that. But anyway, one of the doctors who actually has been, you know, trying to find alien contact, she would not be happy being on the planet knowing what she knows because she can never talk about it. So she actually goes with the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed.
So why couldn't Adrian do that? Just come with Data.
And it's a similar situation with Star Trek 4, right? With the Dr. with Gillian Taylor, am I thinking? Or
Yes.
Gillian
Taylor. Dr. Taylor.
Okay. So she also has this, you know, she has this relationship where, you know, she's the one that gets involved with the crew, in this case Kirk. And yes, you're right, in this episode, the Adriana has the Odjan has the connection with Data, and then, you know, also the scientist with Riker, and they end up having to be slightly divorced from their from the planet that they're going back to or remaining with, and in the past they've often made the jump onto the ship.
Mm-hmm. And obviously we'll be doing the voyage home in 2 seasons time, but still
this time next year.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. But the disappearance of Dr. Gillian Taylor doesn't mean anything to history. I find that very odd. It just seems like plucking one person from the past and taking them to the future. It doesn't matter who it is. It has to be some kind of change in effect. No matter how minor. Anyway, so... Okay, here's some very, very important information. Do not forget this, guys, because you're going to be reminded again. Goshavan's grandfather was buried on that mountain. Remember that. Goshavan's grandfather is buried on that mountain. What do you think of what they did for the planet? They brought water from the mountain. I mean, they did a lot of work on this planet. I can understand why they did still want to give it up.
No, yeah, sure. Now, do you think the colonists like overreact? Do you think that they push Data back too far? Go on.
Well, if you're asking, do I think the reaction and their stubbornness is reasonable? Yeah, I do actually. It'd be something if some starship comes here and says that we must leave because the Martians want this planet, they own it, and we got to go. I don't know. I'm not so sure I'd like that either. Look what all we've done.
No, sure, I agree, and I don't take the side of the colonists, but you can certainly see where that's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that this is this is 3 generations, maybe 4 at most, of people. There has been clear hardship within living history. People know of people, or they would have been alive at the same time with people that would have been part of the of the crew that crashed and so on. So they do know, this is very, very real for them. And I think the pushback that they receive, and in particular Data receives, is I think is pretty honest. And I think that this is what you would get. And I know that it might be slightly heavy-handed to say that, my grandfather, brought the water across. But I do think that kind of stuff would be around, certainly. Mm-hmm. And it is, it's clearly a very big achievement because... I doubt they started with 15,000 people. I suspect that's, 4 generations in after people have been born and they've grown the population. And there were clear sacrifices that they would have to make in order to get this world to be anywhere near habitable. So I certainly can see where the colonists are coming from and why they wouldn't be giving this up at all.
Mm-hmm. Did you kind of pick up on Goshavan and the Ardrian connection? I mean, does he not come off as a little bit jealous?
I can see that. I don't know if it's very explicit or whether it's whether he's jealous on a personal level or whether he's jealous because he can't offer what Data offers the Ardrian character, because the technology is clearly just not there on the planet, and Data walks in as a shiny new toy. So I don't know whether it's a kind of like a personal issue or whether it's just the circumstance of the uniqueness of Data.
No, for some reason he just came off as jealous to me. So poor Data, he isn't much of a negotiator, and he feels like he's failing in his mission. And the only thing that's going to bring him around, perhaps, might be a kiss. Do you find it reasonable that Ardrian would have kissed the android?
I mean, despite not being a big fan of the kind of the relationship romantic angle, I can see that. And then when Data tries to analyze it he stumbles across the thing, oh, you must be showing me support or whatever it is, and I think that again I take that as being perfectly believable. Data doesn't. I think there's something clearly there with. Between them, or it is coming from one side that Data doesn't feel or doesn't isn't aware of.
Okay. One of the things we glazed over is their attempts to try and use the transporter. They had these little cylinders.
Cylinder. Little cylinder, where are you? Cylinder, you were here a month ago. Now, I knew you didn't just roll out of the airlock all by yourself. Now, where are you?
They're pretty tall cylinders that I assumed they were beaming onto the planet and then beaming back from the planet to the ship, and they would all be mush, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, at one point, I'm curious about this. At one point, Picard decides they're going to go confront the Shellyak, and they're going to meet them halfway in space. So they leave the planet, and they're at warp. When we go back to the transporter room, and we still see them beaming cylinders somewhere and beaming them back. And as each time I assume that they try, it works just a little bit better than the last time. So I'm wondering, in this case, where are they beaming it to and from? I mean, let's skip the whole JJ idea that you can transport from Earth to Kronos. That's just, no, it can't be. There has to be some kind of limit on transporting, so especially since they're not using subspace transporting, I guess. How far do you think the Enterprise could have transported to be able to do that while they're at warp?
Oh, I seem to remember there was something mentioned that okay, what episode is it in? I think it's in 11001001, where they are still in the starbase, or they are pretty much just about to leave the starbase, and they mention, can we beam aboard? And it says, no, they're out of range, and they are literally within throwing distance from a rock's perspective,
right?
And apparently it's out of range of transporters. So I think that's the shortest transporter range you'll ever see. In the episode, actually, it didn't occur to me that they were beaming down to the planet and beaming back up again to see the impact. I actually thought, and I don't want to come across as a complete apologist here, I thought they were just doing some simulations with some... they obviously knew what the radiation was. They obviously knew how they would have to reconfigure the transporter in order to get it through. And I thought they were just running tests. So they would probably have a new way of the pattern being integrated or pattern being sent, and they send that only across, and then they bring it back. And I always got the impression they were beaming within the ship, but they were using funky ways of beaming, which clearly haven't been tested.
Fascinating. I mean, the only thing I could think of is they put a hyperonic radiation field inside the holodeck and then transport in and transport out. Other than that, I can't imagine how the transporter would just do simulations using real cylinders. The computer could do simulations all day long and probably figure out the point, but they're actually doing by hand each cylinder one by one as they're making calculation adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I always thought that they were beaming down to the planet. Maybe if Data looked, he could see a cylinder. Oh, looks good. Then, once it leaves and comes back, oh, no, no good. Or the cylinder, probably, I was also thinking, every second the cylinder is there, it's just melting and melting and melting. And the second attempt with the cylinder is much more intact is probably because they beamed it back faster. Good points. I don't know. Okay. So, Goldshipman calls for a public meeting to tell the android to go packing again. This time, Data tries reverse psychology. It looked like it was actually working there for a while.
Yeah, I agree. Although, I have to say, I've been spoilt with the term reverse psychology, because just as a small digression, I used to watch a lot of The Simpsons, and there's a scene in The Simpsons where Homer tries to use reverse psychology on a pigeon. And they're fighting over some food or something. And then Homer turns around and says, well, okay, I'll use reverse psychology. I don't want it. And then the thing just flies away. So whenever I hear reverse psychology now, I always go back to that scene with someone trying to use reverse psychology on someone that's clearly never going to react to it. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I actually like this scene. I like this scene a lot. I think that Data is very effective. And it's all very good points that he's making. And certainly, I think it's not quite now, but it does later turn up that he expects them to be wiped out from orbit. I think it's a
it's later.
I think it's a nice. It's a way that clearly is going to cut through kind of the bravado or the, you know, the false sense of enthusiasm they're going to see by pretending they can stand their ground when that's not really the case.
Right. Well, I mean, no, on this particular time that he talks to him, he's clearly telling him, you're going to die, but you're brave. Your children they're going to know that they're dying for a good cause, for land. You're all a bunch of idiots, but you're brave to do it. That's the reverse psychology of it. It was another meeting that he actually, when he gets his phaser to work somehow by, you know, ripping something out of his arm. Okay, so now we have to try and meet up with the Shellyak, and we need to somehow communicate with them, which we seem to do very good, but we have to be extremely precise. So let's have a language lesson. Sismarath. We never did find out what she said. Liquid, brown, hot, glass, brown, jerk. I mean, you know, we conceptualize the universe in pretty much the same way, but we still don't know what Sismarath is. So anybody out there going to a convention and you see Marina, you must ask her, what is Sismarath? And report back to us.
She's not going to know.
No, of course not.
She's not even going to remember the episode.
Of course not.
I don't think.
I mean, there's got to be somebody just geeky enough to go, hey, Marina, do you remember? In the instance of command, you said Sismarath.
And also, the thing about Marina Sirtis, certainly at conventions, she has a tendency to shout these people down as well.
Really?
Yeah, she'll rip people. She'll rip people a new one if when that being like that. So, yeah, please do it and report back.
Do it anyway, huh? Okay. So it's basically it's William Shatner's Get a Life for real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
By the way, I do think, you know, I think Marina Sirtis, well, Troy, has a very good point, right? It's... When you do think about the idea of a universal translator, you're assuming, you're making a lot of assumptions, and you kind of need things to, you know, you need to be able to construct sentences or even think about things in the same way, right? Mm-hmm. If someone, you know, the idea of having two things and abstractly having this concept of numbering is a pretty alien thing to most life forms on the planet. And it's, you know, one of the tests that you might put there for intelligence or higher intelligence or whatever. But it's not, you know, it's not guaranteed that this is the only way of viewing things. The things that we take away, the way that we look at the world, the way that we choose to abstract certain things and to, you know, to notice color and, you know, to notice color and hardness, but not necessarily other things. It is perfectly valid. Unfortunately, what I get out of this little scene is that, yeah, you're right. The universal translators don't make sense in any way, shape, or form. And they're just drawing attention to that.
Mm-hmm. In other words, Picard has to come up with some really long words before he can talk to them. Because we don't converse, we gibber. According to Shellyak.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what do you think of Goshevin zapping Data and knocking him out?
Actually, just rewatching this for this show, I realized that, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, they are trying to draw parallels between the story that's going on the ship and the story that's going on the planet. So you've had the various attempts of Picard communicating with the Shellyak, and you've had various attempts of effectively Data trying to communicate to the colonists. And the way that they have the scene when Data gets shocked is at the same time that when Picard's on the Shellyak ship and he gets shut down as well, he gets, you know, sent home on his transporter. And, you know, rewatching it, it was very clear that they're trying to draw parallels there between, I suppose, you know, two reasonable people, our cast and crew, trying to communicate with, you know, the externals and being, you know, those other people not listening. And in Data's case, they just try to switch him off, and in Picard's case, they tell him to go away forcefully. I always like the ability to shut Data down by shocking him or stabbing him through the chest or whatever. That's I for whatever reason, that always tickles me.
You like it when people are abusive to Data.
Well, I in particular, I love it when so there's an episode in Series 7, which is Thine Own Self, which is when he goes down to the planet and it's the Mr. Radioactive one. And again, they react very badly to Data. I mean, much worse than in this episode. And I think he gets a pitchfork through the back in that one as they try to turn him off. And I just, you know, I think it's great. I don't know. And then, you know, they bury him, they beam him up, and they fix him again.
Yeah.
So, you know, no harm done.
Interesting. So if Data was ever sentenced to death, they'll just go ahead and turn him off, and then you take him and just, you know, turn him back on.
Well, maybe let me be a bit clearer. I think Data was always my favorite character in TNG, and these little instances that you see, whether it's him displaying his, you know, super agile reflexes, whether it's him not quite understanding that he's not being able to get through to the emotional side of the argument that needs to be made for the colonists, and then indeed him being shut down, all of these kind of signify him being slightly removed from you know, the rest of the humans. And the thing that I always identified with Data was how he was removed, how he was different. So I see these things as being just indicators that he's different. So when I say I like it that he gets, you know, he gets in several episodes, you know, his face ripped off and you can see his circuitry underneath. I like him being highlighted as being different because I, you know, I've always identified with Data in that way.
Yeah.
We're both robots.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or machines, which is machines of a different type. Okay. So, Picard meets with the Shellyak and tries again to give them more time, but they ended up hanging up on him again, so we're in a deadlock. You know, they're going to have to go through me to get to the colonists on Tal Cygna 5. So, anyway, after Data wakes up, because he has sub-processors that, you know, can just turn himself back on after a while. I guess that was his unconsciousness for a while. He got punched in the nose or something. Just like everybody, they always, you get punched in a certain way and boom, you're out for 20, 30 minutes. He wants to use a phaser, but they don't work. So he uses his own neural subprocessor from his arm to build a smart phaser. And it seems like from that point on, he can't use that arm. It's just kind of like sitting there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I think they did mention that you made a smarter phaser, and kind of. I mean, it wasn't quite a smarter phaser. It was just one that needed some, you know, constant readjustments of the beam or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, it's okay.
Okay, so we're almost coming down to the end where, you know, Data decides to give them a little demonstration. So he even warns them that he's coming to destroy the pumping station. When he gets there, he phasers three or four people. Now, they seem to have weapons in their hand of some kind. Obviously, it wasn't going to be forced pulse weapons like the phaser. They had to be more of those things that you have to touch Data to actually do any good. So, you know, they didn't know Data would be coming back with the phaser, I assume.
No.
So they were completely at a disadvantage. And that's exactly what happens. Data shoots a pumping station and it has a ripple effect. You know, it affects the entire thing all the way up to the mountain where Goshevin's grandfather is just spun around in his grave. But what do you think of I thought the effect was pretty good when Data shoots the bottom of the pumping station and you see the effect. Boom, boom, you see your explosions all the way up the thing to the mountain.
I think it's nice that they do that. I was just, in the back of my mind, I was trying to work out what is carrying the energy. So why it's kind of spreading all the way up the hill. I haven't quite worked it out. Maybe there's a power relay that goes up there as well to keep pumping the water. So Lou, what do you think about actually, you know, Is Data right to take this action in order to change people's minds?
Well, first of all, I think since water is a conductor of electricity, enough electricity from the phaser could have followed along the path of the water supply all the way up. But here's another thing. It looked like if you look at the piping system from the mountain all the way down, it looks like there are several conduits going to groups of houses. So my guess is, if that's the case, it would have went into every house and destroyed their plumbing supply, I suppose, all the way up to the mountain. But your question, is Data justified? Yeah, they're going to lose that anyway. We know it's a given that within a matter of a few days, the Shellac is going to come and destroy this planet. I don't know if maybe they'll look at the water supply and say, well, they did a good enough job. We'll keep that going. Or maybe they're just going to completely obliterate the planet and everything in it and start over. So, yeah, they're going to lose it anyway. He needs to. He's demonstrating that this is what you're going to lose. I'm just one android, and I was able to destroy your entire everything you've done here. I was able to destroy in 10 seconds. Imagine what they're going to do to you when they get here, and you won't even see them.
Do you know, I'm not convinced that he is justified in taking the action. Good comes out of it, that's for certain, because otherwise the people would have resisted and there might have even been, you know, riots or whatever. But I'm not convinced that he had the authority to do so. And I don't think they follow up on that, right? When Data ends up speaking to Picard or, you know, checking in at the end of the episode, it's not really anything that's covered.
Hmm. So I can imagine his mission report. Let's see, I beamed down to the planet. I talked to the leader. He said, go away. I went into the home of one of the people on the planet. She kissed me, and don't know why yet. And then we tried again. I tried reverse psychology. It didn't work. Then Goshevin zapped me, and gosh darn it, that hurt. And so I woke up and came up with a plan to destroy their pumping station. I carried out said plan and then told them what they were facing, and they agreed. End of report. So, do you think maybe that might catch Starfleet's eye? You did what? I mean, okay, here's the thing. They were settlers that were on their way to Septimus Minor. Are they still under Federation control?
Well, I suppose the question is anyone under kind of like Federation quote-unquote control in a way? I suppose their parents were citizens of the Federation. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that must include a certain amount of rights as well as obligations on their behalf. So, although they have the right to be citizens, I don't think they can just go around and, you know, violate laws and violate treaties. So I suppose at one level, you know, the Federation does sign a treaty. Federation people can't go and break that treaty without them becoming effectively criminals. And then, yeah, you are justified in going down and kind of, you know, arresting them and forcibly moving them, I suppose. Mm. Does Data need to take this action now? Rather than wait for them to be, taken in the middle of the night by transporters, or by sending down their heavies in 2 weeks' time when the ship arrives, I don't know. I think this is much more of a, I'm going to try to convince you of my argument by using, you know, if you think what I'm doing currently is bad, you better wait until the Shellac get here.
Right.
So I'm not really sure. So I think it certainly works out well, right? I think if you've managed to get the cooperation and if it all works out, it's a good thing to have done. But I'm not necessarily convinced that he had, you know, authority or the right to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in two minds, I suppose.
Because I wondered at any point would the Prime Directive apply, of where, you know, Data ends up saying the choice is yours. You know, and it takes the rise of the people against Goshevin to make them see that this is the way it has to be. But they still said, no, we'll rebuild the pumping station, you leave. Is the Enterprise obligated to just leave them alone and let them face their own destiny? Or are they still Federation citizens and they have to be protected whether they like it or not?
I mean, at a certain level, right, the question there is that, you know, are you willing to let some members of society commit suicide in a way? And I think in our world, I don't think the state has the right either to prevent people committing suicide or also to prevent people choosing not to receive medical surgery or medication that would save their lives. So I suspect they would have, you know, I suspect that they perhaps they would have viewed it in a similar way and just assumed that, look, we're going to tell you the information, we are going to try to convince you to leave, but if we're not successful, then, you know, good luck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, we come upon this again in DS9 when Kira's got this, you know, lovely little Bajoran grandfather type who refuses to leave his home so they can tap that moon for its for resources that would help all of Bajor. And again, they decided, and this is a completely different society, but they actually sent people to take this guy off the planet.
Actually, you're right. You're right. That episode is because Kira does exactly the same thing, right? Doesn't she burn the house down?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure she does. And that episode was a little more. So one thing that we haven't really touched on this is that, you know, there's never any question about whether or not this planet is they're allowed to legitimately stay on this planet. So with a lot of the other episodes that touch on this issue, there's always in the background, at least, the concept of forced relocation, not least with the Maquis, where they had settled on planets for, you know, for hundreds of years in some cases, and they had been, you know, they would have been handed over to the Cardassians. So I don't think I think that's probably a debate for another day. But in this case, yeah, I think in this case they probably would have walked away and, you know, let them meet their maker. And I suppose, you know, Data's actions, I suppose, you know, they helped the situation, of course. But again, I'm just still not quite, in my mind, I haven't figured it out whether or not he was right to do so, even though, you know, even though it was the thing that led to the least harm, I suppose.
Well, I guess if, you know, they want to file a destruction of property report against Data, they're going to have to leave the planet to do so. So, okay. All right, so Data's demonstration was pretty powerful, and I actually liked the way he handled it. I liked the words he used. His lines were pretty nice, dead on, and it has the ripple effect. So Kentor and the others decide there are other places, other challenges. So I guess Goshevin gives up. Or does he? I mean, we really don't know the status of Goshevin. Maybe he figured, you know, you guys can leave, I'll stay. Do you think he may have done that?
No, I think that I think that, I mean, so he comes across as being, you know, the political leader, right?
Yeah.
He's always a character that wants to be in control. And the thing that obviously Data represents is that, you know, he's coming with news of something that he can't, you know, that he doesn't have control over and he didn't even see coming. So I think that I would imagine someone like him, as soon as he's able to find his feet again and take the initiative, you know, say they find a new planet or even they find two new planets and a decision has to be made which one they go to, I think he would be on the front foot.
Mm.
His character would be on the front foot attempting to take control of that situation. I think it's that because he's so much on the back foot in this episode that he gets very much, he gets reactive to the situation at hand. At least that's how I read him. Perhaps I'm being too kind to the character.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay. All right, so back on the ship, we get another brilliant solution to this deadlock. Pursuant to paragraph 1290, he's requesting a third-party arbitration of their dispute, which he has the right. Furthermore, pursuant to subsection D3, he names the Grizellas to arbitrate. However, they're in their hibernation cycle and will reckon in 6 months, at which time we can get this matter settled. Brilliant. Brilliant. And at first the Shellac say, impossible. We can brook no delay. this time, Picard gets to hang up. Oh, we did forget how Picard and Troy went to the ship. And they hung up again by beaming them back to the bridge of the Enterprise. So what do you think of that solution?
Oh, I think it's exactly the solution that needed to be, that Picard needed to come across. So, I mean, as I mentioned, that you have these two storylines going on. Data has to learn how to effectively put it into their words as to how you make the solution and how to solve the problem. And in that case, it was literally blowing up the place and making them see how real all of this is. And it's just not a hypothetical thing that's going to wipe them out in 4 days' time. And Picard, on the other hand, has to move away from diplomacy, and he has to become, you know, effectively like a lawyer and, you know, follow in certain conventions to the letter. And he has to go into that kind of perhaps almost more logical kind of realm rather than trying to, quote, work things out like reasonable people. And I think they both do well. And I like the solution that Picard comes up with, and in particular, the fact that he catched them out on this kind of subclause that you probably, you know, you probably never foresaw that you'd be able to use it in this way. I quite like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's really great, right? When he ends up hanging up on the Shediac, and then they call back, and he wanders around the ship, and he even goes over to the plaque and gives it a bit of a wipe. He's playing it cool. He knows he's in control in that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That was fun. Sir? You know, give him a minute, Worf. He'll be with them in a minute. Just let him hang on. Any answers, and
you may have your 3 weeks, Picard of the Enterprise.
I would have went for 4. I mean, what if the? Who's winning the race?
The race? That is a helicopter.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought it was a car swinging by.
They must be after me.
Well, no, because you'd still hear them. And they'd have the flare on your house, you know, bright spotlight. Anyway, so I would have went for 4.5 weeks. I would have said 5 weeks. I mean, you're going to get your 5 weeks anyway. Doesn't matter, 6 weeks, 7 weeks, whatever. You're going to get it because it conforms within the time frame of your waiting for the Grisellas. What if the colony ship was destroyed on its way, and they needed another colony ship, which would take 4 more weeks. So I wouldn't have timed it so precise. I would have allowed myself a couple extra weeks, just in case.
You know, I agree. I mean, so you've got a cast iron way of getting 6 months, right?
Yes.
So you say, well, I'll be nice to you. 5 months.
Yeah, exactly.
We might be finished in 2, but 5 months is what you're going to give me.
Right. Give me 2 months, yes. Because now, another thing, what happens after Data beams back up and reports to the captain? Do they just leave, or do they at least start the evacuation, sending shuttles down to at least get a start on it, so when the colony ship arrives in 3 weeks, and at least we are underway? But we have no idea what they do.
I'm a bit confused by how does it work that no one can go onto the planet because it's a horrible toxic radiation.
Right.
But they're then going to send a ship that's going to send shuttles down to the planet, and then you're going to go back to the planet. So once the Shediac move in like 3 weeks' time, right, they're going to get to the planet. Not only is there going to be the colony there, but there's going to be like 18 shuttles with the pilots passed out.
Automated. I mean, I don't see why they can't automate a shuttle. But
that's actually
a good point. I mean, obviously, the pilot's going to have to hold his breath while everybody starts loading in the shuttle. I don't know. It's a good point. Or how about when they finally get him back on the ship? Are these people infectious in any way? I mean, even the solution, the antibody that they created to fight their hyperonic radiation, could it be like the children, the advanced children that Pulaski had to deal with? Could they give them any kind of virus?
No, I mean, you'd hope not.
Yeah.
Because otherwise there's going to be a follow-up episode of this.
Yeah, right. So I guess maybe the cylinders in the transporter room could have been given off some kind of radiation. They were affected by it. So, who knows? Okay, but anyway, you know, they don't have to wait. The Forge comes onto the Borg. LaForge comes onto the bridge and says they can do it. They can modify the transporters. Splendid! It'd take 15 years and a research team of 100, but... Crap, never mind. Never mind. Do you think maybe LaForge might have not given up? Maybe in his off time, he's still trying to figure out how to manipulate the transporter for hyperonic radiation?
Well, it's more than 15 years since the episode aired, so I appreciate he probably didn't get his research team of 100. But, you know, we could now be living with this great technology if he had only been dedicated enough.
True. Yeah, we would have been able to transport through hyperonic radiation, but we can't. We still can't because he didn't follow through.
But I'm a bit confused as to how you should read the Geordi line, because he kind of bursts onto the bridge and goes, "Hey, I fixed the problem." I go, "Okay, but not for another 15 years and 100 people working on it." And to me, I don't think he wouldn't know how long it's going to take them to solve the problem. So I didn't get it. I really didn't get whether or not there was a joke or
Or if he was serious. Captain, you got to believe it. But we can do it. I'm telling you, we can do it. But it's going to take 15 years. I mean, if we hadn't gotten the... If we hadn't gotten the Grisellas as a means for us to get out of this problem, and him coming onto the bridge saying we can do it, it will take 15 years... I don't necessarily believe that Picard would have said, "Okay, thanks anyway, but we'll just go ahead and put that on hold." Obviously, that wouldn't have been a good solution to the problem.
No, obviously not. I don't know, and I don't know whether Geordi was going to come along and say, "Look, you know, we could do it in 15 years, but for you, you know, it will be 7."
Yeah,
or, I don't know.
It's interesting because as far as I could figure, Geordi, at the time they found the solution of the Grisellas, Geordi would have been en route to the bridge. So unless this is the view screen is being piped through the entire ship all at the same time, including the comm system, Geordi at this point has no idea that the concession has been given. So why would he come on, give him this news as if he was excited about it when 15 years obviously won't help them?
Right, I suppose in Geordi's defense, right, I know that he obviously knows what they need, the transporters for, but he was given the task of finding a way of beaming through, not necessarily finding a way of beaming through before the 44-minute episode is finished.
Mm.
So maybe he's just taking things very literal at this point.
Yeah, I always picked it up as in he's just being sarcastic and, you know, being funny about it. So
you expect that had it not been the case that Picard had an alternative way, he would have turned around to Geordi and fired him like all those chief engineers from season one.
Yes.
It's the way you hand in your resignation.
Yes.
Okay, Captain, I can do it, but it's like 8 years away. You're fired. Get out.
Yes. Get me that chief engineer with the really big beard. McDougal or something? Maybe he can do it.
No. I was going to say...
Argyle.
Biff Yeager played...
Yes, Argyle.
Played Argyle. Yes.
Yes. Biff. Bring Biff. He can do it. Okay. Well, just like, the next episode, when we have Dr. Crusher going, "I understand what Pulaski did." You know,
but I don't think any of it ever worked.
It didn't work. You know, we have to wipe his memory. Yes, I know what Pulaski did. I've got it. Okay. And when we get there, we have to discuss what happened at Starfleet Medical. Something went on to bring her back. So we'll get to that next week. Okay.
So is Crusher in this episode?
Yes. Yes. Is she in the episode? Well, because she talks about her Lance work with radiation therapy.
It's mentioned very briefly, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. How can they do this? Well, my lands work with radiation. I don't know what lands work is, but do you?
No.
Okay, good. Well, anyway, she was apparently, you know, working with someone named Lance. We don't know who he is.
That's exactly it.
That's it. McDougal. Okay. So Ardrian has to say goodbye to Data, and she's really, really sad because, you know, he hasn't offered to let her come with him. So he's so sweet, and he gives her a little kiss goodbye because she appeared to need it. All right, so we are down to the final scene where Picard congratulates Data on a job well done. And Data notices that he's listening to the recording of his recent concert, and he enjoys playing it because his performance shows feeling, which Data says he had, as he had to remind others, he has no feeling.
I really like this episode because it's a really nice Data episode.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't mention the, yeah, you're right, the episode gets topped and tailed with, Data, you know. I think even the whole concept of Data wanting to play music, right, and, you know, and having a relationship with that is something that is nice, and it's very much a childlike relationship. It's one of the things that you often see. You see this childlike android taking his first steps into being able to reproduce music and understanding it and having his performances listened to and stuff. And he was very, very shy to begin with. Well, shy is probably not the right word, but that's what you'd project onto this kind of behavior if it were a child. And then when he ends up speaking to Picard at the end, he probably gets reassured that he should be on a more solid foundation than that. And all of the story on the planet is really Data learning about, there is this relationship that he's probably just too naive to recognize with the lady. And he also finds that his original way of trying to communicate with the leaders doesn't get through to them because they don't want to hear it, or they don't want to have it explained to them logically. And, all of this just, I think, allows very nice character development for Data. And I really like how this all goes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then, unless you have anything more, why don't you take us into our final thoughts?
Okay, well, it's now time to give a rating on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. So, I've just given a little bit of a roundup on this one. I do like this episode a lot. It's a relatively, I'm going to say small, but it's not small, right? They have the set, they have the big, there's lots more people involved. So, but at its heart, it's a story, in my opinion, about Data learning. And I think it's very nicely mirrored with the Picard storyline on the planet. So, not on the planet, on the ship, and him having to deal with effectively being stowed in a different way by, the Sheliak. I really like this. I think it worked well. I remember growing up always being connected to Data, and I like the way that he solves the problem that is put in front of him this week. In my mind, this is a very good episode. I'm going to be giving it a 4 out of 5.
Okay, well, my final thoughts are, this isn't the first time a girl has fallen for Data, and I'm sure it won't be the last. You don't have to laugh at it this time either. Yes, the first girl was intoxicated-like, but, don't tell me other ships' girls haven't gone gaga for Data. Somebody has, or somebody will. I like this story. I like the deadlock breaker for both sides, for both the A story and the B story, I guess you can call them. We didn't identify it as such, but they are an A and B story, even though it's pretty much about the same thing. The solutions to both were terrific. It didn't feel like they got to an end and said, we have to come up with something. Let's just make it this. So I would like to see the Treaty of Armenes, but all we see is a little glimpse of it on the ship. And I believe that Memory Alpha has other pictures of the treaty as it's shown on the screen. Thank you, Memory Alpha, because they also told me that it's at the end they were playing Eine Kleine Netz Musak second movement, Ad Andante, A-N-D-A-N-T-E. So I will look that up, put that at the end of the show. Let's see here. The deadlock breaker was funny, both sides. The first one, Data's, was a little more serious because of what he did. But still, it was a good solution, whether he should have or not. In the end, I think it's a cute story, which I believe deserves at least 4 dead grandfathers buried on that mountain.
Very good, very good.
So that'll be a 4 for me as well. We thought alike. So, you know, maybe unlike last week. Who knows? We'll see. All right, everyone. Okay, stick around for the forum feedback for this episode.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation, the crew discovers the sole survivors of an alien massacre.
The attacking force spared you for some reason.
They're guarding a dark secret.
Tom! Stop!
A mystery that's destroying Troy's brain. A threat that's attacking the Enterprise.
Commence rapid fire with all weapons on full.
On Star Trek The Next Generation.
Okay. Well, join us next week as we review Season 3, Episode 3, The Survivors. I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. So take care, thank you for downloading, and good night.
Good night.
All right, guys. And for those of you staying on for the forum feedback, we are going to be doing Shades of Grey, Season 2, Episode 22, in which case we had Cena with us. And it's actually brought out by Karen McDuff. He says,
I'm delighted to see...
No.
When's Kieran coming on? He's gonna start getting annoyed by this.
Booby trap.
Okay. So 10 weeks away, I suppose.
Yeah, August 8th. Okay. Sorry about that, lad. Okay, he says, I'm delighted that Cena was on this podcast because she's really adept at finding positive in just about everything. Except Cat's Paw.
So Cat's Paw was brought up on an episode of Desert Island Trek, and... I believe that it was the Desert Island Trek. I think it was Furbob's Desert Island Trek that... when I say Desert Island, I don't mean Desert Island, I mean Shipwrecked.
Shipwrecked.
The one where you take the 5 episodes and you say that, you know, you could jettison these off into oblivion. Mm-hmm. And I believe Casper was brought up, and Season isn't the most appreciative of the original series.
I think that it's
just not what she grew up with. And I think she ended up watching Casper and thinking that it was really, really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I think I put out a challenge a little while ago, and I said that I would watch Cat's Paw myself, which I did, and it's not good. I seem to have memories of it being better, but it's not good.
I have memories of a lot of TOS being better. Okay, I don't know why, but as I get older, it's farther and farther from my most watched list as I get older. I don't know why. Okay, so anyway, he's going to try and do the same, he says. Given that this episode was done in the greatest of mitigating circumstances with limited budgets coupled with the writer's strike, I have to say they actually did their best in a bad situation. The first 15 minutes aren't bad. It's a reasonable premise that you could pick up something nasty on an away mission, and it's a storyline well trodden through TOS in the past. The humor is probably the best aspect of the episode, and Riker handles difficult situations in pretty much the same way I would, so I can appreciate the aspect of it as a personality trait I more than recognize. But that's it. Ultimately, this episode is crap. 15 minutes doesn't make an episode. You need another half hour. And what probably speaks volumes for this episode is that I'd honestly rather watch any of the other shows than watch this clip show. So yes, I appreciate that you could watch this episode and decide what to go back and watch, but to be honest, I'd still have to sit through this episode to do that, and there aren't any previous episodes that I'd be missing out on that would make it a good thing. Okay. No, not even Code of Honor. I'd rather that watch that borderline racist nonsense than this. Borderline? Maybe I can look at it another way. When I think of a certain episodes when I think of certain episodes, there's usually a key point in the episode that I instantly remember. For instance, Code of Honor, I think of the line, "No vaccine, no Lieutenant Yaw." Good job. Best of Both Worlds, I think, "Mr. Worf." Fire. Complete with dramatic music, which I did, thank you. But this episode, if you say TNG Shades of Grey to me, the first thing I think of is, "Data, something's got me!" Did I do good on those, by the way?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
I knew there was a reason why you wanted me to post this week.
Well, I was trying to get you off the hook. We're going to pay for these comments, I got a feeling. Okay, so, I don't... which is actually Skin of Evil, that's right. I don't think of this episode. I think of another episode because I used a clip from it repeatedly. I don't think of this episode. I think of another episode because they used a clip from it repeatedly. It's a waste of an episode. What do you think he means? Well, let me go on and see. Okay. Let's leave that to one side and pick up on a few things mentioned in the podcast. 3 × 10⁸ power. A number worn into my brain from school. I couldn't tell you whether that's the speed of your neurons or not, but I suspect it probably is. It's probably the speed of light through a vacuum, though. So I know James was right about that. Any comments?
Actually, when I listened back to this episode, I did realize that I didn't make it as clear as I should have done. That so this is the speed of light, and it's correct. It's the speed of light in meters per second through a vacuum. When you move into the world of electrical impulses, whether it's just electricity going through copper wire or whether it's signals being sent through the nervous system, it's going to be slightly less than that number. And if we're talking about a virus propagating through the nervous system, of course, on the grounds of the virus has mass, it can't travel at that speed. And I didn't think I made that as clear as I should have done in the episode. That's all the comments I have.
Okay. Why wouldn't a parasite, virus, bacteria travel up Riker's leg at that speed? Well, it's Riker. No one makes their way up Riker's leg quickly. That's just bad foreplay. All right. On a related note.
One second. I recently listened to the... because we've been on a little bit of a hiatus for a couple of weeks, I've managed to catch up with our podcast, and I am a weird individual that both records this podcast. Well, I don't really record a podcast, right? I have a chat with Lou on a Star Trek episode. He records a podcast, he puts it out, and then I listen to it. So I kind of add a little bit of content that I then later listen to. I had completely forgotten about this idea of Riker pitching a tent, and so I heard it back on the podcast, and wow is all I could say.
The places we go. Hey, I've heard other Trekmate family podcasts.
You started the question so seriously. You went, "So, Doctor, if I could ask you a question here, do you reckon Riker was pitching a tent?"
Because sometimes a setup with you is better than if you know anything I'm about to say. But no, I mean, I've heard some other Trekmate family podcasts that they'd pull no punches. So I'd at least try to have fun with it. But I still have to walk the tightrope with tech podcast. So anyway, so that's what he asked. Is Riker pitching a tent? And he's going to say no. Remember, he initially reporting numbness in his leg. By the time he's lying on the biobed, I'm assuming that numbness has traveled beyond his leg. So even if he's dreaming of a delightful minuet or the dirty Irish girl, I doubt he's showing that. I didn't think of that. It's a good point. And on that related note, I wonder why he didn't dream of this of his early years with Deanna being that part. Unless he did and we didn't see it, I assume that's one of the reasons Deanna is grinning a lot of the time. She's getting to remember those moments too, like that time at the waterfall.
The thing is that we did discuss this on the episode, and in a way, what do you actually want? Do you want the, there is this conceit that Riker has memories of the various people he's met, whether it's Minuet or whether it's the Irish lady, and he's thinking about these scenes that were filmed. But, you know, I suppose what Kieran's asking for here is the dirty action between him and Troy, or him in the holodeck that he's been up to that week. I just don't think you're ever going to put that on the TV.
No, I don't think so. Yeah, no. Maybe, you know, the L-shaped bed sheets where, you know, we see all of Riker's chest, but we see nothing of her. You know, I'd never seen that in Star Trek. Well, no, yes, we have. When Dr. Bashir finally won.
But that in the very last episode.
Yes, it was. That's what it took for Dr. Bashir to finally win. So, okay. The fact he saw things that couldn't possibly see because of the perspective annoyed me, though. But again, mitigating circumstances. Also, I also have to agree the techno babble nonsense. As much as there was a writer strike, someone's still writing this and came up with bad endorphins, good endorphins thing. The replacement with the word cheesecake was a perfect example. Although thanks to that, I now want cheesecake that causes weight loss. Wouldn't that be nice? Or maybe it would be reversing the growth rate of my waistline to zero. I would love to do that too. Actually, I'll be honest. If I found cheesecake that reduces my growth rate to zero, I'd be delighted by that. Amen, brother. Overall, I can't give this episode anything more than a 1. There's just not an episode here. Yes, there are a few bits that make it worthy of featuring in some other episode, but it doesn't stand alone yet. You could probably throw out those aspects into another story entirely and make it the B plot. And that's your best hope, I guess. What we would have here is a B plot that's been made the A plot, left stand alone because it's now no B plot, or there's no B plot, if that makes any sense to me. But let's remember that even bad Trek is still Trek. So in that case, a 1 out of 5 is at least 3 out of 5 in regular shows. Is he trying to confuse me? And of course, it could be worse. It could be 50 Shades of Grey, although we all know that probably would feature Riker too. What's 50 Shades of Grey?
Is this a serious question?
Yeah. Is that a movie?
No. Yes, it is. It is a a series of books, or at least the 50 Shades series is a series of books from a writer that originally started writing fan fiction for the Twilight series. So the story goes that, you know Twilight, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Twilight, there are various characters, and I think what they decided to do, you know, this woman ended up writing a slash fiction for Twilight stuff with, you know, heightened sexuality and some SMM in there as well. Mm-hmm. And then it eventually got published as 50 Shades of Grey after they had changed all the characters and removed kind of, you know, any reference to Twilight. It became very successful in the book circuit, and it was kind of referred to as mum porn. So it's a like a very, you know, a very sexy book that moms read on the tube. It then, I think it spawned at least another 3 books off the back of it. And I know that earlier this year, I think it was also Valentine's Day in the UK at least, they released the film version of 50 Shades of Grey in the cinemas. So take your wife to the cinema and watch people tie each other up and slap each other, if that's your thing.
Nah, that's okay. Why don't you go into Queen Cat Blue?
I didn't think I was going to change anyone's mind about Shades of Grey. I just wanted to take the opportunity to point out exactly why I don't hate the episode. To your point about Data, something's got me. When I think of Skin of Evil, I think about that gloopy goo of Armus enveloping Riker and Tasha dying, not Riker's cry. So even that scream belongs in Skin of Evil. The fact that it's used so many more times in Shades of Grey and gives the effect of Riker reliving that moment over and over makes me associate it with Shades of Grey. And yes, 50 Shades of Grey would certainly feature Riker and 50 different ladies, aliens or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you one more chance to say that Data Something's Got Me. You didn't have the flair Put on some of your pieces of flair and try that again.
Data, something's got me!
No, it goes up. It's Data, something's got me!
Data, something's got me!
Work on it. We'll try it again next week. Okay, let's end it with Captain Proton, or Ben, saying that you're absolutely right. When I hear Data, something's got me! In my mind, something. It comes to from this episode. Mostly because I, too, think of other moments when Skin of Evil, when I remember that episode. He also goes on to say, the only thing to say about this episode, if the clips came from previously unseen storylines, that would make it a top 10 episode. I believe that's what I said. It would be really awesome. Even if they were cutting room floor scenes, it would still make it good. In other words, I'd like that episode if we'd seen 15 new stories in one, and we'd all hail it as a stroke of genius. Goes to further show how easily bored we become by repetition. I've heard before we are creatures of routine. I suppose we are. That idea has never sat right with me. I see routine as a very way to slide through life and not enjoy life. I crave newness and excitement. So when it comes to an episode like this, I'll let my ears do the watching. Otherwise, my eyes will deceive me and not show me something new. Ben's always got an interesting slant and point of views that sometimes you can't argue with, but he didn't give it an episode or rating.
5.
Nah, I doubt it. I mean, I don't think he can give this a 5 legitimately. So, he didn't give it a rating, so we'll have to do it for him. 1.5. There are 5s in it somewhere. All right, thanks, guys. And we'll see you next episode.